announcements from the lawyers that are participating in these cases. The two cases, the first one is 0318381CR, Crispin James Harmel, the appellant versus the state of Texas, appellee. And for the appellant?
Kristen Jordan for the appellant, Your Honor.
Okay.
Santa Barbara for the state of Texas.
All right. And if y'all want to come on up and get set up. While we're calling the other case, the next case that we'll be having on the this afternoon's docket is 0318740CV, John Gannon, Inc., appellant versus the Texas Department of Transportation, James M. Bass, in his official capacity as executive director of the Texas Department of Transportation, and Kyle Madsen, in his official capacity as the director of right-of-way for the Texas Department of Transportation, appellees. And for the appellant?
Richard Rothfeld, Your Honor.
Thank you. And for the appellee?
Susan Fallon, Your Honor.
Thank you. As you all know, we have each side gets 20 minutes to argue their cases. These seem pretty straightforward cases, so usually we reserve 5 minutes for the appellant's rebuttal, unless you tell us otherwise. I'm assuming that you've let the clerk know what time issues you have. Okay, thank you. Regarding our lighting system, when the yellow light comes on, that means you have 2 minutes left in your argument. When the light turns red, feel free to answer whatever question that has been posed to you, but pretty much wrap up after that. If you have something urgent that you need to address, please seek leave from the court before you do so. Today's proceedings are being recorded, but only audio. The audio recordings are available on the court's website, usually within a day or two. By way of housekeeping, if anyone has any cell phones or other devices that would make noise or otherwise disturb the attorneys in these cases or the court, please turn them off or silence them now. And for those of you in the back, we have this nice little audio system here. There's no speakers for you in the back, so if you can't hear, you're going to have to move farther up. This is simply for the audio purpose only. It's not for to help y'all in the back. Sorry about that. And with that, I think we'll proceed with 0318381CR, Crispin James Harmel versus the state of Texas.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I proceed?
Yes, please.
As I said, my name is Kristen Jernigan. I represent the appellant in this case, Crispin James Harmel. I think that the main issue in this case is whether or not the evidence is sufficient to show that Mr. Harmel intended to cause the death in this case. And it's my position, obviously, that the evidence is insufficient to show that for two reasons. First of all, the state never proved that it was my client that actually strangled Ms. Kaler, the victim in this case. There wasn't one witness who testified that he was the perpetrator. In fact, the state's own expert witnesses testified that they weren't there to say whether or not he committed the act, just that an act was committed. There's no DNA, there's no confession, there's no physical evidence. There is evidence, actually to the contrary, that Ms. Kaler was actually walking around hours after this alleged attack occurred. She was in a parking lot. Two people saw her. She was in the parking lot for several hours. No one called 911. Some testified that she appeared to be acting a little strangely, but she was walking around talking. The evidence that there was a lack of evidence that my client actually caused this death. Now, even assuming for purposes of this argument that the state had shown some testimony that it was actually my client that committed this act, which they did not, but for purposes of this argument, they still couldn't show that he intended to cause this death.
Yeah, that's what I understood your briefing to be more arguing, that was the real argument, was that the mental state was not shown.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes, and to that point, Again, Ms. Kaler was alive when my client left her. She was alive for hours. The testimony from the state's own experts, first of all, they disagreed on whether or not she was strangled once or twice. They testified that the time between someone is strangled, loses consciousness, loses control of their bodily systems and dies is 1.5 to 2 minutes. And it's undisputed that my client left Ms. Kaler at 2:54 a.m. Okay, she was not pronounced dead until the next day, sometime in the afternoon. She was seen last, I think, around 10:30 or 11 a.m. Walking around. So it's contraintuitive to say, well, he intended to cause someone's death, but they didn't die. I mean, he left her alive. There was testimony that from both experts that even if you lose consciousness, you're still breathing. I mean, you're still, your body's still trying to recover.
Well, but isn't that irrelevant whether or not she was alive? I mean, if you think about somebody who shoots someone and leaves and they're still alive, I mean, isn't that, how is it your belief that a strangling event can never be intent of death? Or just talk to us about why strangling would not show the intent that he intended Ms. Kaler to die.
Yes, Your Honor. So this case is a novel case for this reason, because the state's theory was delayed strangulation. My research, I haven't found another case in Texas where this theory has been put forth, okay? So what the state's theory was that...
Well, could it be that might be because most cases don't have evidence of video in a Walmart parking lot? I mean, if this, would have happened, say, in a field in the country, hypothetically, an act of strangulation occurred, and then a few hours, the person's left alive or not. No one really cared one way or the other, the person who did the strangulation. And then the next day, the victim shows up dead. Well, I think the difference here is simply just that there's a video.
Well, there's a video that shows the two of them together. There's not a video of showing him attacking her or strangling her, anything of that nature. They have to show that at the time this allegedly happened, which again, I'm not conceding that it was him that did this, but that at the time that it happened, that he intended to cause her death.
And why should this, why was the jury not free to consider, like they would in any other case, the circumstantial evidence that they had before it?
Because the circumstantial evidence in this case, really the only evidence, was the what the state referred to in its brief as consciousness of guilt. They say that because he gave inconsistent statements to police officers and things of that nature, that shows his he thought he was guilty. When there's a whole lot of reasons why people lie to the police, not solely because they committed a murder, but also consciousness of guilt is one of those principles like flight. To rest an entire prosecution on consciousness of guilt to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, that's not enough. And in fact, the jury told the lawyers when they were speaking to them after the case that the state's case had holes that you could drive a truck through, and that they took a leap of faith, hoping they were right. Now, the state argues that I shouldn't be allowed to use that statement under Rule 606B, but I went back and read the rule. The rule, and actually I'd read it before I filed my brief too, but the rule says that during an inquiry about the validity of a verdict, a juror can't testify to it, but they can talk to anybody they want to after the trial is over. I mean, last week, Amber Geiger's jurors were on Good Morning America talking about how they got to their verdict.
But how is that in the record before this court?
It was a sworn affidavit from an investigator who heard the statement when it was made.
And I would like to talk to you about your argument on intent to know that it seemed to me that there was an assertion that your client had to know about notions of delayed strangulation in order to form the requisite intent to commit this murder. I've not found anything in support of that.
Well, I didn't either, Your Honor, because I don't think there's been a delayed strangulation case before. So I think if the argument is, in its simplest terms, if he's strangling her to try to kill her, but he leaves her alive, then he would have to know that later on she could die from this strangulation. I mean, which is why this makes this prosecution so far-fetched to me. I mean, because if he had to form the requisite intent at the time he committed the act, but he left her alive, then the only way they can prove that is to say, well, then he must have known that by strangling her, she could die later.
What if he didn't know that she was alive?
There's no evidence of that in the record. I mean, the experts testified they couldn't say whether or not she went unconscious or not. They couldn't say, you know, in fact, one of them testified that the medical examiner testified that there wasn't even any evidence of brain damage. You know, because the state's theory was she got brain damage during this event and then, like, slowly died. But they both testified that when someone's strangled and they die, it's a period of 1.5 minutes to 2 minutes by the time the airflow is blocked off. So this is a very novel case concerning a novel theory.
Well, correct me if I'm mistaken on the evidence that was contained in the briefs, and I haven't had a chance to look at the entirety of the record before the court yet, but my understanding is the last time the victim was seen was about 1:42 a.m. in the Walmart parking lot getting back into her vehicle, and that she's not seen again until by anyone or any video until about 9 a.m. the next day. Is that accurate?
It's missing one little part.
Okay.
So they get into her car and drive. The Walmart video shows them driving off. Okay.
Right.
Her car is later found in a parking lot with it was like a CC's pizza and like that kind of stuff. So the Walmart, from what I remember from reading the record, and I could be wrong, but from what I remember, the Walmart video didn't go that far.
Okay.
So it was eyewitnesses who saw her the next morning when they were showing up for work.
Okay.
So and that's the problem with this case too, is we don't know what happened between 1:42 a.m. and 9 a.m. I mean, it's entirely possible it was a different perpetrator. And so that's what goes back to, you know, what I originally started with. There's no evidence that even if this strangulation happened, you know, in between that time, and we don't have any evidence that my client was the one who did it.
Okay, and so then help me with how we get to this body not being the 13th juror, because that's not our charge either.
Right.
So how do we get beyond being that 13th juror and not deferring to the verdict that came out in this case?
Well, I think the way that you get there, Your Honor, is that the state's case, two ways. You have, I think, two choices. First is the state's argument that consciousness of guilt alone should establish sufficiency, in my opinion, is incorrect. I couldn't find any cases. They may be out there. I couldn't find them where it said that consciousness of guilt alone is enough to establish sufficiency of the evidence. I did find a case from Houston, from the First District, which is Roberson v. State. It's 80 Southwest 3rd, 730, and I can supply it to the court in a supplemental brief. It does say that consciousness of guilt is not enough to sustain a conviction.
Feel free to do so, and I'm assuming that you'll want to respond.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's,
and it's 80 Southwest 3rd?
80 Southwest 3rd, 730.
Thank you.
The other way you get there, Your Honor, is that I think what happened in this trial is there was a variance in what was charged in the indictment and what was proven in trial. I still don't think there was enough to prove that it was my client that committed this act. But I think that the other way you get there is to say that what the state charged was that he intended to cause her death, but at the most, what the state proved was that he committed an act that was dangerous to human life.
Like a felony murder?
Right, yeah. Like a felony murder. So, you know, and if they had charged it as a felony murder, we might be in having a completely different argument. Because assuming, you know, he was the one that strangled her, again, I'm not conceding that, but assuming it was, then the most he did was commit an act that was clearly dangerous to human life. So I think there's a variance. So without becoming the third juror, I think you can also say, you know, in addition to consciousness of guilt alone is not enough, I think you can also say there was a variance between what was pled and what was proven. And I think those are the two ways that you get there without becoming a 13th juror. And I want to, I wanted to talk about there. It's, and it wasn't just the jury that had questions, or at least one juror that thought that there were holes in this case. Dr. Dolanak, who was the medical examiner, it took him 5 months to come to a cause of death. He was, by his account, he wasn't able to do it, and it wasn't until he went back and did some research and looked at crime scene photos and all that kind of stuff that he decided that it was a homicide. But when he was asked, and I think I wrote down where it is in the record, whether he thought it was delayed strangulation, he said he could not say whether or not the death was immediate or delayed. And that's the state's own expert. So this whole theory of delayed strangulation, I think, is with this set of facts, is an unreasonable interpretation, because the nobody can say whether or not it was in fact delayed. I mean, what if she was strangled at 8:30 a.m. and then somebody saw her at 9 a.m. and she passed away? I mean, it's a novel theory, and I expect that, should we not prevail in the courts of appeal, that you know, there will be a writ on this, I'm sure, challenging these opinions and any science behind that, because I didn't hear any science about it during when I read the record.
I don't think there's any dispute. This is a very unusual set of facts.
Yes.
I think everyone on the court would agree with that.
Right. And on this unusual set of facts, and with, you know, the state hanging on consciousness of guilt and all of these questions, you know, my client is serving life without parole.
Mr. Ernigan, I know you're almost at the end of your time here, so I want to shift focus a moment to your jury charge argument regarding extraneous acts.
Mm-hmm.
And so you cite to Rankin in your brief, talking about anything that's not in the indictment can be an extraneous act.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you reconcile that with Coffel v. State, the Texarkana case? I don't know if you're familiar with that. Isn't that an overly broad reading of Rankin and extraneous acts?
I don't think I'd agree that it's a broad reading. I think that the way that you classify bad acts hasn't really, we don't have a set of rules for it. And so I think that what's a bad act to someone might not be a bad act to someone else. I agree with that. But I think in this case, the reason the extraneous offense instruction was so important is because it was my client's inconsistent statements that the state relied upon, and those could be considered bad acts. And if they're instructed that they can't find that beyond a reasonable doubt, and then not to consider it, then the state's really not left with much evidence. So I see my time's up.
May it please the court, there's overwhelming evidence of guilt in this case. Mr. Harmel is seen on video following Jessica Caller out of the Walmart and getting into her car after her on the driver's side. The video also shows them returning a little over an hour later and parking in a Little Caesars parking lot across from the Walmart. Mr. Harmel gets out of the driver's side, walks across the Walmart parking lot, gets into his vehicle, and drives away. Ms. Caller's car never moves again, and she is found dead inside 12 hours later. Mr. Harmel has never disputed that he is the figure on the video. He has admitted to being in her car and is seen on a different video using her debit card to pump gas immediately after leaving her. In the days following her death, he changed the appearance of his truck and threw her debit card away. When interviewed by the police 5 days after the murder, he told them that he had met her on a hookup website and that they had prearranged to meet. He said they went to a park had sex, and that he saw her drive off after she dropped him off. But there is no evidence of them ever being in contact before he kidnapped her. And her car never moved again after he left it, as evidenced by a 13-hour-long video. He also indicated that she was driving the vehicle when they returned from the park. But when asked why her driver's seat was pushed so far back that she would not have been able to reach the pedals, he said that he did not want to think about it because it was gross. This is significant because he was not told any details relating to her death before then. There's no question that Mr. Harmel intended for her to die. There's both a ligature mark across her neck and bruise inconsistent with manual strangulation. She also had several defensive wounds and a mark on her shoulder consistent with her seatbelt being forcefully pulled against her. He applied enough force to her neck that her hyoid bone was broken, and she had also defecated, which requires at least 30 seconds of oxygen deprivation. It is unique that she did not immediately die after he strangled her, but she had suffered so much brain damage from oxygen deprivation that she was unable to get help. When she was found, she was sitting on her cell phone. It had 28 missed calls on it, and the ringer was turned all the way up. Yet she was not able to answer it or ask for help. As to the jury charge, Your Honor, in Delgado is clear that a limiting instruction for extraneous offenses must be requested when the evidence is admitted. At no point in this trial was that ever requested until the jury charge conference. As for the other points, the state will rely on its briefing.
Ms. Harp, let me go back to this, to the 404B argument. So at the trial court, the prosecutor, the ADA says, this is not extraneous in response. But then in the state's brief, it says, oh, these are admissible under 404B, and then says at the end, and it may not be 404B to begin with. So I want to address, is the state's position that it was admissible under 404B, or that these things that the defense complains of aren't 404, isn't even 404B evidence at all?
Your Honor, yes, the bad acts could be considered extraneous offenses. Lying to the police, throwing her debit card away, being on a sex hookup website, I guess could be construed as being a bad act. But is the state's position that regardless, it would be admissible as showing consciousness of guilt? And the appellant in her brief on page 19 and 20 actually says that that evidence does go to consciousness of guilt.
Okay, and but let me stop you for a second. So one, the state didn't say that at the trial court. The state said, no, this is not extraneous evidence. So if it's your position now that it could be, what's lacking from the brief is a harm analysis. So what's then, why is this not harm if you're making the statement now that yes, this could be considered extraneous? And the instruction wasn't given. Is it waiver because they didn't ask for it at the time, or what's your response to? I'm really concerned more about the harm analysis, but what's your response to that?
Yes, Your Honor. The response would be that it is waived. That a limiting instruction should not have been included just because it was not requested whenever the evidence was admitted. As far as the harm analysis, if there was error, any harm, well, there would be no harm. And the reason for that is because a hypothetical charge would have said that this evidence would only be able to be used to prove consciousness of guilt. Consciousness of guilt can always go to the intent of a person to commit a crime. So even with that limiting instruction, the jury still would have been free to infer from the evidence that he did intend for her to die, and he did intend to avoid prosecution. If there are no further questions.
Well, so then the harm analysis is going to be under B, right? Non-constitutional, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
No objection, and it's non-constitutional error, is that right? Because it's admission of evidence. Okay. And do Do you agree then, because I'm hearing a fair amount about consciousness of guilt, do you agree with appellant's suggestion here that, I mean, essentially that you're hanging your hat on consciousness of guilt, that that's kind of a pivotal point to show intent or to show the requisite mental state necessary to convict?
Yes, Your Honor, but we would contend that that would just be one piece of the evidence. The severity of her injuries would also go to intent, and the direct evidence of having him on video leaving her vehicle, and then nobody else is seen getting in or out of it during that time frame.
Well, now, so help me out with that, because I there's no video one way or the other after 2:52 a.m. when they return. I'm sorry, after 1:46 when they left the Walmart parking lot. Or is that not a correct statement of the facts in this case?
Your Honor, there is a video. Okay. And the state would be happy to provide the video that was shown to the jury. The video goes
It should be in the record. That's what I'm saying. I mean, I haven't looked at it yet. So that's what I was asking for clarification earlier.
Yes,
on that my understanding of the state of the evidence is that no one saw anyone come in or go out of her vehicle after 1:46 until she was seen by a witness walking around the car, obviously in a state where she looked bad or awful or whatever the witness testified to. And I was corrected by Ms. Jernigan saying there was no more video after they returned to the parking lot of the pizza place. Is that accurate or no?
That is incorrect, Your Honor.
Okay. There is additional video after 1:46.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And that would be?
The video shows them returning to the parking lot at about 2:52 a.m. And then the video has been
to the Walmart parking lot or
no,
the,
Your Honor.
The pizza place?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And the video has been, as it was shown to the jury, the
right.
video was edited to show everything pertinent that had happened.
Okay.
So the video shows her and him both parking, getting out of their cars, going into Walmart, getting into her car, leaving. The video also shows them returning to the Little Caesars parking lot, him getting out, walking across the parking lot, getting into his truck and leaving.
Right.
There is also testimony that there was a 13-hour-long video that was positioned on her car during that entire period of time.
But there was not video admitted into evidence before the jury, and that's the difference. Is that?
Yes, Your Honor. The
okay,
video
now I get it. Thank
that
you.
Was admitted to the jury shows, and then it goes all the way from him getting out, walking, getting
right.
his truck, driving off. It shows all of that.
Okay. I understand. Thank you.
And what's your response to Ms. Jernigan's argument about delayed strangulation as something that's brand new? And, you know, is this even, can this even be cognizable as murder? This new concept of delayed strangulation and Dr. Dolanak struggling with making this conclusion?
Yes, Your Honor. It is unique, but as Justice Goodwin said, it's almost the same as if he would have shot her in the face and then just walked away, and instead of immediately dying from the gunshot wound, she died from bleeding out. It would be the same scenario. If there are no further questions, I yield the rest of my time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
May I continue?
Yes, please.
Okay, and I want to clear that up, Justice. The trial lawyers that tried the case are here, and I consulted with them just now. There was a video of the whole thing. Mm-hmm. I got confused with my memory because it wasn't admitted
Understood.
To the jury. So to me, when I watched it, ended at 1:42 or whatever. But there's a whole bunch of that wasn't on tape. So I'm sorry about that. But I want to correct a couple of things. If I can grab my so first of all, in my brief, I never use the words consciousness of guilt to describe the 404B evidence. I think it's just regular It's 404B. What I cited was the jury has a natural inclination to infer guilt when they hear, you know, that defendant has been untruthful or done something that looks like he's trying to cover something up. As far as talking about the admissibility of evidence of consciousness of guilt, there's a difference between whether it's admissible and whether the jury gets instructed on it.
What's your response to Ms. Harp's comment that the defense waived that by not asking for a limiting instruction when that information was introduced throughout the testimony? I think it was a detective.
I think it was a detective.
Bond.
Right, Detective Bond. And I think if I remember correctly, there were objections made to the extraneous offense evidence, but I don't think a limiting instruction was asked. But
I could say I've just reviewed the testimony mm-hmm. before I came down, and I did not see any objections to extraneous, you know, an extraneous objection during that testimony. So okay. If there's something.
I could be incorrect. There were two trials of this case.
Yes, we're aware. I think everyone's
right.
aware.
So I sort of get them confused right. when I'm thinking about Bond's testimony. But I think that you can still instruct the jury on whether or not they can consider extraneous offense evidence, even if you haven't requested a limiting instruction, because what you're telling the jury is how to consider the evidence. You're not saying, and interestingly, this whole argument wasn't made at trial. The state just said, well, it's not extraneous. You know, they didn't say, well, it's consciousness of guilt, and you know, you didn't object, and all this kind of stuff. And I will say that, you know, I've reviewed a whole lot of jury charges. And I've never seen a murder case that doesn't have an extraneous offense evidence charge. I don't see the harm in giving it. I mean, I think it's a protection there that is important in a case where a defendant is looking at life without parole. And I think that to say that there's overwhelming evidence in this case that my client intended to cause Ms. Kaler's death is incorrect. I mean, it's all, you know, well, you know, he was on the video and he lied about it and all that stuff. But in a case that's novel, as this one is, that's before the court about whether or not you can intend to kill someone but leave them alive. And there's a difference between shooting someone in the face and someone, you know, being strangled and then dying 13 hours later. I mean, you expect when you pull the trigger of a gun that if you shoot someone in the face, that they're going to die.
But is it then your belief then when somebody strangles another person, it's never their intent to cause death?
No, that's not my contention. I think that my contention is that when someone strangles someone else but then leaves them alive, they're not dead, then that's contrary to their intent. And there's a case that I cited, I was just trying to find it in my brief, where in fact the defendant did shoot someone and they said that wasn't enough to infer his intent to cause the death. Yes, he intended to shoot the person, he didn't intend for them to die. And in this kind of murder case, that's what the state was charged with proving. Is shooting someone with a gun an act clearly dangerous to human life? Absolutely. Is shooting someone, you know, and you're supposed to guess what their intent was? I mean, that's what the cases say. I've briefed them in my argument. So I think the real issue is in a case like this with a delayed strangulation, well, we think a delayed strangulation, you're left to guess with what his intent was, and that's not proving it beyond a reasonable doubt. I think that also relying on consciousness of guilt to infer intent to cause a death in a murder case, I don't believe that's allowed under our law either. And so with that, I see my time is up. I would ask that you reverse the conviction in this case. Thank you, Your Honors. Thank you.
This cause will be submitted. And y'all are excused. And if the